Today, the cats among the pigeons. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 4th of August 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. Here is the link, and I'll add it to the comments below. A big week of news to cover, so let's get straight in at the deep end with the Productivity Commission report on competition in financial services, which was released on Friday. The final report, which was released earlier than expected, really highlights the never mind the customer attitude of the industry and its regulators. They call out regulatory failure and conflicts of interest across the sector, referring to opaque pricing, unsuitable products, no reward for customer loyalty, as well as product complexity and fair competition. Major players have too much market power and have fingers in multiple segments of the market. Customers lose out as a result. They made a wide range of recommendations, including the introduction of a best interest obligation for all providers in the home loan markets. Mortgage broker trail commissions should be phased out. ASIC to ensure that the interests of borrowers are adequately safeguarded in the lender's mortgage insurance market. APRA is singled out for myopic regulation. The ACCC should focus on encouraging competition across the industry and safeguarding the interests of consumers in the regulatory system. The new payment system needs a proper access regime, and the Payment System Board from the RBA should ban all card interchange fees. We discussed the implications in our recent video, and the link to that is above. In summary, a number of critical reforms which, if implemented, could certainly change the landscape for financial customers in Australia, and for the better, whilst clipping the wings of the major incumbents. We discussed this on ABC Radio. Good job, Productivity Commission. Now let's see if the government is up to the task. There was a bit of good news this week on the retail front, with turnover for June, the month of the end-of-year sales, where deep discounting was the hallmark. The ABS says that retail turnover rose 0.4% seasonally adjusted, which follows a 0.4% rise in May. The trend estimate, which I prefer, reported a 0.3% June rise, following a rise of 0.4% in May. Compared to June 2017, the trend estimate rose 3.1%. In trend terms, clothing and footwear rose 0.7%, department stores rose 0.5%, and household goods 0.3%. Across the states, New South Wales and Victoria rose 0.5%, the ACT 0.8%, and Tasmania 0.9%. Queensland was flat, and WA rose just 0.1%. So again, there are significant variations across the states. Online retail turnover contributed 5.7% of total retail turnover in original terms. This means households are spending more than their income by continuing to tap into their savings. So it will be interesting to see if the retail momentum continues or sags in July after the end of the season sales. Continuing the cat among the pigeons theme, ANZ parted company from the competitors by cutting its variable home loan rate for new customers. While banks, including the CBA, have cut fixed loan rates and offered honeymoon deals in recent weeks, the ANZ is the first to move on variable rates. The ANZ told mortgage brokers it was bringing down its basic principal and interest home loan rate for owner-occupiers by 0.34 percentage points to 3.65%. The ANZ offer only applies to new customers looking for a loan valued at 80% or less than the value of their property. And loan to values above 80% will remain unchanged at 3.99%. As we discussed in our separate post, ANZ ups the ante in the mortgage wars, and here is the link. The industry is homing in on lower risk customers in an attempt to maintain loan book growth. We also discussed this significant event on 2GB's Money Show with Ross Greenwood, and here is the link to that if you want to hear our discussion. As Ross said, picture the lions around a shrinking watering hole trying to protect their territory. Also this week, ASIC released their review of exchange-traded products, or ETPs, in Australia. These are open-ended investment products that are traded on a securities exchange market. ETPs trade and settle like shares and give investors exposure to underlying assets without owning those assets directly. they differ from listed funds because they're open-ended. This means that the number of units on issue may decrease or increase daily, depending on investor demand. And ETPs, especially exchange-traded funds, the ETFs, are increasingly popular with retail investors and self-managed superannuation funds. This is because of their accessibility, perceived low cost, transparency, intraday liquidity, and diversification benefits, as well as the ability to provide exposure to new asset classes. And there's been a steady growth in both funds under management and the number of ETP products available on the market in Australia. But ASIC called out a number of concerns, including the question of spreads and liquidity, the concentration of market makers, and the lack of good disclosure. So more of the same old, potential investors should be wary. Data from the Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia, the HILDA survey, came out this week and showed again the rise in the proportion of the household population who's renting. With the number of Australian renters who eventually become homeowners plummeting over the last 15 years, particularly for those between the ages of 18 and 24. The survey found the overall proportion of people living in rental accommodation has increased by 23% since 2001 to 31.3% in 2016. And they called out the growing evidence of intergenerational inequality. The data also chimes with our surveys that more households are under financial pressure thanks to flat incomes and rising costs. And it's worth highlighting their data only runs to 2016, so it's already a couple of years old. We think the trends continue to grow based on our latest mortgage stress data, which, by the way, will be out next week. And another survey from mortgage lender State Custodians found that as many as 15% of surveyed households have faced challenges when trying to refinance due to falling property prices. The figures published by State Custodians also revealed that young people were the most affected, with around 34% of those under the age of 34 saying that they'd been unsuccessful in refinancing because of declining property values. This highlights the rise of mortgage prisoners who cannot refinance to get the better deals because of little or no equity or other financial pressures. And talking of households in financial pressure, the number of Australians falling behind on their mortgages will rise in the next 2 years as interest-only loans end and repayments get more expensive, ratings agency Moody's warned this week. Delinquencies on loans that have converted from interest-only to principal and interest are running at double the rate of those still on interest-only, they said. About 40% of loans by Australian banks in 2014 and 15 were interest only for 5 years, meaning a large proportion are set to come under pressure with higher repayments in 2019 and 2020, says Moody's. This backs up our findings, which estimates that more than 970,000 Australian households are now believed to be suffering housing stress. We discussed this in our video, Wither Interest Only Loans. Genworth, the lender's mortgage insurer, released their 1H18 results this week, and their profit remains under pressure as claims rates rise. The delinquency rate increased from 0.51% in the first half of 2017 to 0.54% this time. They highlighted increases in the number of delinquencies in Western Australia, New South Wales, and to a lesser extent, South Australia. This was partially offset by a decrease in delinquencies in Victoria and Queensland. New delinquencies, they said, were down for the half, 5,565 compared with 5,997 last year. Delinquencies in mining areas, they say, are showing signs of improving, but in non-mining regions, there are indications of a softening in cure rates. Turning now to property, the home price slides continue, as we discussed in our post. Home price falls are just starting, more to come. And discuss the importance of looking at the local micro property markets, as the averages mean absolutely nothing. For example, over the past year, prices are down more than 20% in some suburbs, and not necessarily where you might expect. And talking of videos, do check out the latest in our series of Adams North discussions, The Great Airbrush Scandal Policy Failure of the Year, where we dissect APRA's bank stress tests and conclude that they are not fit for purpose. This one has already generated a large number of comments and observations. John suggests our regulators are asleep at the wheel. You can also read his original article. CoreLogic says auction volumes are lower across each individual capital city this week, with 1,224 homes scheduled to go under the hammer, down from 1,536 last week, a further sign of weakness in the property sector. Melbourne, in particular, is slowing fast. Last week, the homes taken to auction across the combined capital cities returned a final auction clearance rate of 55.6%, down from 57% the previous week. Over the same week last year, 1,987 homes went to auction, and that was a clearance rate of 68.7%. Melbourne's final clearance rate was recorded at 58.5% when around 802 auctions were completed last week, compared to 59.9% across 613 auctions the previous week. This time last year, 956 houses were taken to auction across the city, and a much stronger clearance rate was recorded at 75.6%. Sydney's final auction clearance rate came in at 52.4% across 469 auctions last week, down from 55.2% across 407 auctions the previous week. Over the same time last year, 714 homes went to auction, returning a clearance rate of 65.4%. And across the smaller auction markets, clearance rates improved across Canberra and Perth, while Brisbane and Adelaide saw clearance rates falling week on week. There were no auctions recorded in Tasmania at all last week. Of the non-capital city auction markets, the Hunter region was the best performing in terms of clearance rates, with 10 of the 14 reported auctions, or 71.4%, followed by Geelong with a 65% clearance rate across 20 results. The busiest region for auctions was the Gold Coast, where 39 homes were taken to auction, and they returned a clearance rate there of just 32.3%. Building approvals in June were slightly stronger in trend terms, rising by 0.1%, as reported by the ABS. The mainstream media fixated on the stronger but less reliable seasonally adjusted figures. Among the states and territories, dwelling approvals rose in June in the Australian Capital Territory at 5.8%, South Australia 5.6%, Northern Territory 4.8%, Tasmania 2.2%, Western Australia 1.7%, and New South Wales 0.2% in trend terms. Dwelling approvals fell in trend terms in Queensland 1.6% and Victoria 1.2%. Overall momentum is slowing, in our view, as demand for high-rise investment apartments ease. And overall lending for housing is still tracking higher, despite investor lending sliding, according to the latest RBA and APRA figures for June. Owner-occupied housing lending rose 0.6%, or $6.6 billion, to $1.18 trillion, while investment lending fell $800 million, down 0.1% in season-adjusted terms, or rose $1 billion, up 0.2% in original terms. I have no idea what adjustments the RBA makes. It's not disclosed. Investment lending fell to 33.5% of the portfolio. Total lending for housing is a new record at $1.77 trillion. And remember, this is a time when housing debt to income is knocking on the 200 door, and we are one of the most in debt nations on the planet. Lest we forget, loans eventually need to be repaid. We discuss both the credit data and the building approvals in our video, Another Housing Record Set. We have not fundamentally addressed the credit elephant in the room, despite all the noise perhaps the regulators would like to tell us. How much debt is too much? We clearly have not hit their pain threshold yet, despite the rising financial stress in many households. And so to the markets. Locally, the ASX 100 finished down a little on Friday to 5,126, still significantly higher than earlier in the year. The banks were down. For example, CBA fell 1.15% on Friday to end the week at 72.83 in reaction to the Productivity Commission report. Westpac fell 0.96% to end at 28.91. AMP also fell down 0.85% on Friday to $3.50, despite a broker's report suggesting that there may be long-term value in the stock after a restructure. The market was perhaps not convinced. The Aussie was below 74 cents against the US dollar, despite a small rise on Friday, to 73.97, but higher, up 0.29%, to 505 against the Chinese yuan. It appears China is flexing its currency muscles in response to the US trade tariffs. The Bank of England lifted their cash benchmark rate 0.25% to 0.75% as inflation is above the lower bounds target, despite the uncertainty surrounding Brexit, be it hard or soft. The Aussie was up 0.62% on Friday against the UK pound to 56 cents in reaction to the news. Across the pond in the US market, Apple took market attention for a host of reasons this week, including reaching a historic Wall Street milestone by becoming the first US company to hit $1 trillion in market capitalization just before noon on Thursday. Shares closed solidly above that on Friday at $207.99. Shares moved into trillion-dollar territory following a strong earnings report earlier this week. On Tuesday, Apple's fiscal third quarter results beat on the top and bottom lines, driven by sales of the pricier iPhone X and subscription revenue to services such as Apple Music and its app stores. Apple also lifted the cloud that was hovering over the tech sector following weaker reports from Facebook and Twitter. The Nasdaq ended the week at 7,812, a strong finish but not quite a record despite the Apple price. The S&P Information Technology Sector Index finished at 1,277.05 on Friday, which is slightly higher than the previous week. The July US employment report gave the market more evidence that the economy is humming along at a pace that won't alarm the Federal Reserve. Although the rise in non-farm payrolls was less than expected for July, job gains for the two previous months were revised up by 59,000, making the overall rise about in line with forecasts. And average hourly earnings showed wage inflation at the same year-on-year pace as before. So that leaves the Fed set up to continue its plan of gradually raising rates. The economy is growing really strongly, and headline inflation is set to hit 3% next week. So the case for September and December Fed rate hikes remains strong, ING Chief International Economist James Knightley said. Fed fund futures are still pricing in the next rate hike to be at the September meeting, and odds for an additional increase in December remain little changed after the release at around 65%. The Fed had its say this week as well. The Federal Open Market Committee kept rates unchanged as expected and also kept the language in its statement substantially the same. The FOMC said it would continue to expect that further gradual increases in the target range for the federal funds rate will be consistent with sustained expansion of economic activity, strong labor market conditions, and inflation near the committee's symmetric 2% objective over the medium term. That reaffirmed investor expectations that the central bank remains on track to hike rates twice more this year. The stance of monetary policy remains accommodative, thereby supporting strong labour market conditions and a sustained return to 2% inflation, the Fed said in its statement. A report on Tuesday showed that the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, the core personal consumption expenditure price index, which excludes food and energy prices, was up 0.1% and therefore 1.9% on a year-on-year basis. The Fed targets inflation at 2%. Oil settled lower for the day and week on Friday as concerns about a trade war stifled demand and hurt sentiment. On the New York Mercantile Exchange, crude futures for September delivery fell 47 cents to settle at $68.65 a barrel. Oil field services firm Baker Hughes reported on Friday that the number of US oil drilling rigs in operation fell by 2 to 861, pointing to tightening US output. And the weekly oil inventories numbers showed an unexpected rise in US stockpiles, further weighing on prices. In June, OPEC, Russia, and other non-members agreed to return to 100% compliance with output oil cuts that had begun in January 2017, after months of underproduction elsewhere had pushed adherence above 160%. Even though output continues to decline in Iran, Libya, and Venezuela, the survey suggests that compliance had only fallen to 111% in July, suggesting more room for increasing production from the likes of Saudi Arabia or OPEC's non-member ally, Russia. Trade worries oscillated this week, keeping the market on edge amid conflicting reports of US action and proposed retaliation from China. Tensions on Wall Street eased significantly on Tuesday on a report from Bloomberg that both sides were trying to restart trade talks. But that was quickly countered by another report that the US was considering raising tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese goods to 25%, up from 10%, which the White House later confirmed was under consideration. And on Friday, China shot back, with the potential plan for tariffs on $600 billion of US goods, the US side has repeatedly escalated the situation against the interests of both enterprise and customers, China said, according to Reuters. China has to take necessary countermeasures to defend its dignity and the interests of its people, free trade, and the multilateral system. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow warned China not to underestimate President Donald Trump. The Dow Jones ended at 25,462, up 0.54%, high but not at a peak, while the US dollar Chinese yuan sat at 683, right at the top of its range as China exerts pressure on the rate. Bond rates were down a little, with the 10-year benchmark sitting at 2.95%, well down from its 3.12 in May. At the short end, the three-month bond rate was 2%, still at the top of its range. LIBOR is still sitting at 2.34 at the top of its range, signalling higher funding costs in the system. Gold continues lower at 1,222, as many risk investors are favouring the US dollar at the moment. Bitcoin ended the week at 7,443, up 0.65% on Friday, but below its recent highs. So back once again to cats and pigeons. Next week, we'll be hearing the latest from the Royal Commission in sessions covering wealth management. NAB and MLC are up first, but I'll be especially interested in the evidence from the industry superfunds. We suspect more revelations as the committee works its magic, and the results from CBA will be a highlight. And it'll be interesting to see what they report in terms of net interest margins. I'm expecting more loan repricing, both up and down. It's never a dull moment in the finance and property sector, so expect more turbulence ahead. The bumpy ride continues. If you like what you've heard here today, please like the post and add a comment or question. If you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. And thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again next time.